You're listening to part two of episode 567 of Unwelcome Guests.
Whatever people do, the media will always either, you know, make it bigger than what it is or make it smaller. They never just say, wow, isn't that amazing for these people protesting?
Funny, because protest, it's related with breaking, destroying and demonstrating in the Batman.
Can I look? Some people can just do it sort of peacefully
Look, oye, me alegro mucho que hayáis traído el material.
So you bring all your...
Claro. In fact, we were thinking, why not? Maybe we can have like 5-10 minutes to explain this to other people.
There's a
I think that you should just put it like a...
Look, isn't there a board for...
I the same
board
one,
for workshops.
There's board for self-workshops.
Back in 5 minutes, okay?
Fun. There's a notice board to write.
I know. The only thing is that tomorrow at that time I have to be in another one.
No. Well, I see.
Another discussion, but
maybe in the evening.
What do you think? Right. One thing. What do you think drove that to happen? Like, what was the catalyst? What made it begin? I mean, I know it's really good.
Well,
first of all,
really.
No, look. One of the things is that which was the drop that made everything to start, but this, it doesn't start because something small. It's because, you know, you are living a very strong and hard situation, and many things are there. The economic situation in Spain is horrible. You know, look, for example, in Barcelona, there's around 80,000 flats totally empty, but at the same time, you are paying, like, families are paying the 50% of their wage just to pay the rent. Look, or more than the 20% of the people is unemployed in Spain. 45 of the young people below 30 in Spain is unemployed. 45%.
That's mad.
But still, they show to the rest of the people that everything is fantastic.
How did it actually start? What kind of catalyzed people to actually move?
The euro.
Yeah.
So I don't mean the economic. I mean, what got the people actually
this.
Moving to the square to begin with? What was the day?
He said just before it was for the local elections.
One of the things people are talking about is. Basically, in Spain, like Spain has only had a fascism since 1978.
Yeah.
We have to remember that in the late 70s they were doing their hands up, Sieg Heil type salutes.
I lived there then, yeah.
No? So the democracy project is up and running in only, 34 years. Maybe some argue it's not running very well, okay? This movement has been called the Democracy Real, which is like real democracy now.
That's what I've got on my Facebook. That's why I know about it, because I've got that on Facebook. Mm-hmm. But as I say, it's not in the media, not in the general media.
So look, what they said is, okay, now we have the elections, so... let's demonstrate to the people that we don't agree at all with this kind of democracy, where there's just two big parties that they make absolutely the same, and come on, they can do whatever they want, but still we're going to be fucked.
I like kids.
Okay?
You do worse than me.
Yeah, so something that started like this, with this mostly this message, okay, 2 days after the election. And now, what we do? Come on, let's continue, no? Okay, so, like this. Somebody started to go first of all in the Plaza del Sol in Madrid, which was like the center of everything. And somebody decided to sleep there, like a sort of demonstration.
Was someone or a group or something that decided to go?
I don't know who. I mean, I wasn't the first night. I wasn't there.
But it's interesting because it's not like this came out of the blue. Like North Africa, for example, the middle of the square of Plaza Catalunya, there was 3 points. One was Iceland. The other was Tahrir, like Cairo. This, like the top. if you're at the bottom of Spain, you can see Africa.
Yeah.
We're that close to Africa. It seems like a natural next step for this North African
idea. We started in Egypt, didn't it? And it's been moving throughout. And then Greece.
It's a very different country, Spain and Egypt, for example. And the situations are very different. But still, people can't continue like this.
And it is happening in Britain as well.
In Greece, they are much stronger than us. In Greece, they have the balls, you know, like... It's impressive what is happening there.
And upsetness at the same time. It's like it's the image outside. It's like they're not doing anything. But the thing is, like, you don't see they're not getting too organized. And what you have, it's like, of course.
But they're really organized.
They are. That's great.
But you're not seeing what's like, you know, we had a big demonstration in March of a union, and it was massive, really massive march and protest in London. And from that, little groups have evolved of people's assemblies, and they're constantly in London. There's a constant camp set up in London. But what do you hear about it? You don't hear exactly. You don't hear anything about it. And it is smaller than but what I'm saying is that it's having a knock-on effect throughout the world. Stuff's happened in America, but you don't hear about that either.
Yeah, but you know what the butterfly effect is? So it's like something in a very small scale, it can really change the whole system. So I really want to be optimistic, and I feel that something like this is happening.
Yeah, well,
it is happening. That's it. It's happening.
I really.
But I think that it needs to have a body and a head.
Huh?
It needs to have a body and a head, you know, because sometimes I see many bodies shaking because of the anger of the situation with no head.
It needs a bit of organization.
I see many heads with no body, you know, so it needs to get more solidified in one way.
I agree, but the point is that it goes so fast that it's quite difficult to control something like this. You don't know what's going to happen next.
Another interesting point, though, is that there's been some people are calling democracy 2.0. When you look at, especially with transition, one of the reasons why transition has grown is because of how Web 2.0 has come about. Well, the first was just you consume, you check your information. The next was you start putting in your information, you start communicating with each other. That enables ideas to spread virally, to communities start to form, etc., etc. That's been really, I think, one of the keys of how transition has just sparked and grown so big, so greatly, so quickly. One of the arguments is that, okay, the democratic system, especially in Spain's context, is maybe actually something far more interesting and better can take its place, something far more participative. Spain has had a history of very participative-type democracy in the past, so they're aware of that. Part of their talk is about those things and saying now we've got the tools to really enable this, and a part of the decision making processes are the actual the forums or discussion points. They're partly in the real world, but they're also partly in the virtual world. There's like forums for all different topics in all the different neighbourhoods, open forums, and that people, if they feel they want to go and talk there, so they can go in and look more. So it's like, have we the intelligence to actually participate in a healthier, more intelligent way? Of course we have. You know, do people want to? Well, if we don't, what? We leave it in the hands of these politicians, and what do? They leave us in the shit, and it's getting worse every day. No, we've like people are in Spain are saying, ni casa ni trabajo ni miedo. No, neither work.
No home.
No fear. Mm. You know, it's got so bad that they've lost their fear.
Come on.
Yeah. That's how all the revolutions are being triggered, you know? When you have nothing to lose, it's when you just get out of the door and you say, okay, now let's play, you know? Mm. But probably I see that all these things that we're playing around, transition movement, degrowth movement, all them will end up like a kind of solution or a structure, a possible option into what we're going to face in a very short time. I mean, it's going to be in a couple of years.
Yeah, but the people of the degrowth movement, the people of the transition movement, and many other social movements in Barcelona, they're all inside there.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I mean, we're all working together.
Yeah.
With many other people that is the first time that they make something in this.
Yeah, because always it's been like a kind of conflict.
Yeah.
You know, your theory is going this way, no, my theory is going that way.
Let's have a theory of this planet, you know, that's all it needs. It's very simple, isn't it? I know someone's talking about being settled and nomadic, but if you see the earth as your home, you're not a nomad. You can go anywhere on this planet because it's your home. You have a right to go anywhere, and that's all we need, is that theory of anywhere. That's
I would like
that instinct.
I would like you all to see.
Yeah.
Mira lo tú, porque el resto no lo tiene. ¿Cómo está organizada la plaza? Y esto es, luego creció más y evolucionó más, ¿eh? Esto es al cabo de una semana, más o menos. Yeah, but this was after 1 week. So later even evolved more. But it was really, it was like a city.
On his own, and nobody look, said, okay, this is what we need.
So it was amazing. Kitchen, healthcare, there were, you know, houses on the trees, people sleeping on the trees. It was amazing. We had a garden, we had people that always, everything was very clean.
It's part of, because some, in the culture of Spain, there's the go to the square, go to the city for Batallón. And it was big at the start. No, the big Batallón is like, let's go and have a drinking session. And it was like Batallón no es revolución. No, but drinking session is not revolution. It was like, we're here to change the system.
Yeah.
We're not here to just sit around and get
pissed.
That's
a big shift in Spanish culture, actually.
Big shift in any culture. What are you
talking
about?
No, I'm sorry. Drinking, it's something very cultural. It's really in our blood.
Drink on the street is.
It is in English culture.
Yeah, but for use on the pub. Not on the street.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So much this, well, at least you're what we're saying now, this is like in Spain.
No, you're just more open and honest about it. We have to stay behind closed doors.
Okay.
It's cold.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's wet. It's
cold.
It's
a
fire.
Yeah. Very true.
For sure, that's the end.
It's just part of
mankind.
Mankind drinking.
Yeah, so this is more or less...
Suppression.
But it's interesting, I think, the reaction of the British media about all of this. Because as far as I can see, the British media had virtually no coverage of what was going on.
No,
at all. But there was day-to-day coverage of what was going on in Greece.
Yeah, still is.
And my question is why?
Yeah.
It wasn't.
Because it's
it
not about what is going on in Greece.
Yeah, exactly.
It's about the economy. It's about the economy.
It's about the credit, it's about the loans, about
Greece affects us.
About the things, but mostly German banks, you know. It's about this.
Yeah.
It's about the euro, about Europe.
Yeah.
But it's true. Why isn't the British press coming? Because the British press, I mean, they love all these stories. They love seeing revolution and people on the streets. And, you know, they've actually relished, haven't they, the kind of Arab Spring and the whole thing.
But not if it's successful, they don't like it. They don't like it.
It's not Europe.
Spain is
they only like it if it's violent. They only like it if it's violent.
But then with the...
sensational.
The Guardian had some decent coverage. Not stuff that it was maybe appearing in its printed newspaper, but some very good films covering, I don't know, one covered like a woman and her kid who are facing difficulties because of the crisis, another a fireman, some other dude. So basically just three normal people's lives. And why are they going out on June 19th? Why are they gone? And it covered their whole day, what they were doing, how their life has been affected. You know? So there was a bit.
Now, regular Unwelcome Guest listeners, I'm sure, have a more nuanced understanding of the media as a tool of other institutions with more advanced criteria to decide why some things are reported and some things are ignored. Police use of agent provocateur, for example, is openly admitted now that undeniable evidence is easily videoed and posted to YouTube, and yet hasn't come under much media attention. I mean, you might think it would be. If we believe that the police's mission is to prevent violence and make sure that laws are followed, how can we explain the police's brazen admission that they told their officers to pretend to be protesters and incite violence? Now, when police are getting paid to incite violence and law-breaking, that's a pretty clear example of what Illich is talking about, the counterproductivity of institutions. Their survival as institutions has come to dominate any stated purpose. And perhaps that's the logic which explains why commercially motivated media are so desperate for violent images that they will recycle footage of violent Greek demonstrations and try and pretend that that's what's going on in Spain. Now, such mendacious strategies are only going to work as long as people still trust the television and say, "Whoa, look at those naughty demonstrators throwing Molotov cocktails." And you've got to be pretty desperate before you put a Greek policeman and say, "This guy is from Spain." And you've got to be pretty stupid before you fail to notice that. So isn't it sad that anybody even attempted that? And it's also a short-sighted, temporary strategy. People cannot get fooled that way forever. It seems to me like communications are improving worldwide, as is the frustration with the status quo. Witness the examples that we've been hearing on the show. And now let's return to conclude Deschooling Society, written by Illich 40-odd years ago, at a very optimistic moment in history, recalling the hippies and the people coming together, possibly a similar time in history, but one that was followed by the 70s and 80s consumer booms and the ongoing ecological destruction. Must have been exasperating to watch for Illich. And later on in his life, he did develop a more apocalyptic picture of the world to come. Well, I think it unlikely that this current wave of radical democracy, of people expressing their dissatisfaction with the status quo, will be shrugged off with another consumer boom, because when people can't feed themselves and their families, then what is there left to consume? I'm looking forward to a global coming together in which people express their common humanity. As the woman remarked at the end of the last piece, a theory of humanity. Humanity in the best sense of caring for those around us, a movement of people not intent on destroying, ravaging, self-maximizing, but a team of nurturers, people growing food, people who are not distracted by confused ideas of needs or entitlements, people who are not expecting institutions to solve the world's problems, but people who are going about doing what they can already. Now, does it seem likely that one ideology could sweep the world? I'm reminded of a book I once read called One No, Many Yeses. We certainly have technologies whereby ideas can move very quickly and are not stopped by cultural or linguistic barriers, as long as there's machine translations, or better still, polyglots around. I'm also reminded of a problem of agricultural monoculture. If you grow one thing on a very large scale, then all that's needed is for one virus or one creepy crawly to arrive, which likes to eat that thing, and it can multiply and feed very quickly. You've got a much less resilient system than a polyculture, which is the natural approach. Looking on a mimetic level, a cultural level, haven't the would-be masters of the universe, with their limited imagination, haven't they just replicated the Western institutions of finance particularly, and everything else that follows from that, law, government, contract enforcement? All the Western institutions have been mass-produced and spread worldwide, and they're now resting on the ultimate threat of force. The social consensus has been eroded, and it's pretty much gone. Why do people go along with it? Not because they think it's the right thing to do, but because they're afraid for their own personal selves of what will happen if they don't go along with it. That recalling Marx's quote from a couple of episodes ago, cannot last long, and it certainly can't survive a situation in which people feel they've not got a lot to lose. So the idea, for example, that you corporate guys aren't going to feed us anyway, are you? In fact, you're destroying the planet, could spread very quickly in the modern world, because so many previously disparate societies with previously complex social, economic, cultural problems have been reduced to copies of predatory capitalism. The same problems are now manifested all around the world of a small number who claim all kind of legal, economic, and other rights according to these new value systems, claim control over the rest of the population. People do tend to not want to make a fuss and avoid big conflicts, but as we've heard in the show, if they are pushed beyond a certain limit, everything changes. Now, I think Illich anticipated this turning from a Promethean expectation that institutions will manage things for us to an Epimethean discovery that the only real power is the power that we have over our own bodies to do whatever is meaningful to us. So let's hear the final chapter of Illich's 1971 book, Deschooling Society. Chapter 7, Rebirth of Epimethean Man. Our society resembles the ultimate machine which I once saw in a New York toy shop. It was a metal casket which, when you touched a switch, snapped open to reveal a mechanical hand. Chromed fingers reached out for the lid, pulled it down, and locked it from the inside. It was a box. You expected to be able to take something out of it, yet all it contained was a mechanism for closing the cover. This contraption is the opposite of Pandora's box. The original Pandora, the All-Giver, was an earth goddess in prehistoric matriarchal Greece. She let all ills escape from her amphora, Pythos, but she closed the lid before hope could escape. The history of modern man begins with the degradation of Pandora's myth and comes to an end in the self-sealing casket. It is the history of the Promethean endeavour to forge institutions in order to corral each of the rampant ills. It is the history of fading hope and rising expectations. To understand what this means, we must rediscover the distinction between hope and expectation. Hope, in its strong sense, means trusting faith in the goodness of nature, while expectation, as I will use it here, means reliance on results which are planned and controlled by man. Hope centers desire on a person from whom we await a gift. Expectation looks forward to satisfaction from a predictable process which will produce what we have the right to claim. The Promethean ethos has now eclipsed hope. Survival of the human race depends on its rediscovery as a social force. The original Pandora was sent to Earth with a jar which contained all ills. Of good things, it contained only hope. Primitive man lived in this world of hope. He relied on the munificence of nature, on the handouts of gods, and on the instincts of his tribe to enable him to subsist. Classical Greeks began to replace hope with expectations. In their version of Pandora, she released both evils and goods. They remembered her mainly for the ills she had unleashed, and most significantly, they forgot that the All-Giver was also the keeper of hope. The Greeks told the story of two brothers, Prometheus and Epimetheus. The former warned the latter to leave Pandora alone. Instead, he married her. In classical Greece, the name Epimetheus, which means hindsight, was interpreted to mean dull or dumb. By the time Hesiod retold the story in its classical form, the Greeks had become moral and misogynous patriarchs who panicked at the thought of the first woman. They built a rational and authoritarian society. Men engineered institutions through which they planned to cope with the rampant ills. They became conscious of their power to fashion the world and make it produce services they also learned to expect. They wanted their own needs and the future demands of their children to be shaped by their artifacts. They became lawgivers, architects, and authors, the makers of constitutions, cities, and works of art to serve as examples for their offspring. Primitive man had relied on mythical participation in sacred rites to initiate individuals into the law of society. But the classical Greeks recognized as true men only those citizens who let themselves be fitted by paideia, education, into the institutions their elders had planned. The developing myth reflects the transition from a world in which dreams were interpreted to a world in which oracles were made. From immemorial time, the earth goddess had been worshipped on the slope of Mount Parnassus, which was the centre and navel of the earth. There, at Delphi, from Daiphis, the womb, slept Gaia, the sister of Chaos and Eros. Her son, Python the dragon, guarded her moonlit and dewy dreams until Apollo the sun god, the architect of Troy, rose from the east, slew the dragon, and became the owner of Gaia's cave. His priests took over her temple. They employed a local maiden, set her on a tripod over Earth's smoking navel, and made her drowsy with fumes. Then they rhymed her ecstatic utterances into hexameters of self-fulfilling prophecies. From all over the Peloponnesus, men brought their problems to Apollo's sanctuary. The oracle was consulted on social opinions, such as measures to be taken to stop a plague or a famine, to choose the right constitution for Sparta, or for propitious sites for cities which later became Byzantium and Chalcedon. The never-erring arrow became Apollo's symbol. Everything about him became purposeful and useful. In the Republic, describing the ideal state, Plato already excludes popular music. Only the harp and Apollo's lyre would be permitted in towns, because their harmony alone creates, quote, the strain of necessity and the strain of freedom, the strain of the unfortunate and the strain of the fortunate, the strain of courage and the strain of temperance, which befit the citizen, unquote. City dwellers panicked before Pan's flute and its power to awaken the instincts. Only the shepherds may play Pan's pipes, and they only in the country. Man assumed responsibility for the laws under which he wanted to live and for the casting of the environment into his own image. Primitive initiation by Mother Earth into mythical life was transformed into the education, paideia, of the citizen, who would feel at home in the forum. To the primitive, the world was governed by fate, fact, and necessity. By stealing fire from the gods, Prometheus turned facts into problems, called necessity into question, and defied fate. Classical man framed a civilized context for human perspective. He was aware that he could defy fate, nature, environment, but only at his own risk. Contemporary man goes further. He attempts to create a world in his image, to build a totally man-made environment, and then discovers that he can do so only on the condition of constantly remaking himself to fit it. We now must face the fact that man himself is at stake. Life today in New York produces a very peculiar vision of what is and what can be, and without this vision, life in New York is impossible. A child on the streets of New York never touches anything which has not been scientifically developed, engineered, planned, and sold to someone. Even the trees are there because the Parks Department decided to put them there. The jokes the child hears on television have been programmed at a high cost. The refuse with which he plays in the streets of Harlem is made of broken packages planned for somebody else. Even desires and fears are institutionally shaped. Power and violence are organized and managed. The gangs versus the police. Learning itself is defined as the consumption of subject matter, which is the result of researched, planned, and promoted programs. Whatever good there is the product of some specialized institution. It would be foolish to demand something which some institution cannot produce. The child of the city cannot expect anything which lies outside the possible development of institutional process. Even his fantasy is prompted to produce science fiction. He can experience the poetic surprise of the unplanned only through his encounter with dirt, blunder, or failure. The orange peel in the gutter, the puddle in the street, the breakdown of order, program, or machine are the only takeoffs for creative fantasy. Goofing off becomes the only poetry at hand. Since there is nothing desirable which has not been planned, the child soon concludes that he will always be able to design an institution for our every want. He takes for granted the power of process to create value. Whether the goal is meeting a mate, integrating a neighborhood, or acquiring reading skills, it will be defined in such a way that its achievement can be engineered. The man who knows that nothing in demand is out of production soon expects that nothing produced can be out of demand. If a moon vehicle can be designed, so can the demand to go to the moon. Not to go where one can go would be subversive. It would unmask as folly the assumption that every satisfied demand entails the discovery of an even greater unsatisfied one. Such insight would stop progress. Not to produce what it is possible to produce would expose the law of rising expectations as a euphemism for a growing frustration gap, which is the motor of a society built on the co-production of services and increased demand. The state of mind of the modern city dweller appears in the mythical tradition only under the image of hell. Sisyphus, who for a while had chained Thanatos, death, must roll a heavy stone up the hill to the pinnacle of hell. The stone always slips from his grip just when he is about to reach the top. Tantalus, who was invited by the gods to share their meal, and on that occasion stole their secret of how to prepare all-healing ambrosia, which bestowed immortality, suffers eternal hunger and thirst, standing in a river of receding waters, overshadowed by fruit trees with receding branches. A world of ever-rising demands is not just evil, it can be spoken of only as hell. Man has developed the frustrating power to demand anything because he cannot visualize anything which an institution cannot do for him. Surrounded by all-powerful tools, man is reduced to a tool of his tools. Each of the institutions meant to exorcise one of the primeval evils has become a failsafe, self-sealing coffin for man. Man is trapped in the boxes he makes. To contain the ills, Pandora allowed to escape. The blackout of reality in the smog, produced by our tools, has enveloped us. Quite suddenly, we find ourselves in the darkness of our own trap. Reality itself has become dependent on human decision. The same president who ordered the ineffective invasion of Cambodia could equally well order the effective use of the atom. The Hiroshima switch now can cut the navel of the earth. Man has acquired the power to make chaos overwhelm both Eros and Gaia. This new power of man to cut the navel of the earth is a constant reminder that our institutions not only create their own ends, but also have the power to put an end to themselves and to us. The absurdity of modern institutions is evident in the case of the military. Modern weapons can defend freedom, civilization, and life only by annihilating them. Security, in military language, means the ability to do away with the earth. The absurdity that underlies non-military institutions is no less manifest. There is no switch in them to activate their destructive power, but neither do they need a switch. Their grip is already fastened to the lid of the world. They create needs faster than they can create satisfaction, and in the process of trying to meet the needs they generate, they consume the earth. This is true for agriculture and manufacturing, no less for medicine and education. Modern agriculture poisons and exhausts the soil. The Green Revolution can, by means of new seeds, triple the output of an acre, but only with an even greater proportional increase of fertilizers, insecticides, water, and power. Manufacturing of these, as of all other goods, pollutes the oceans and the atmosphere, and degrades irreplaceable resources. If combustion continues to increase at present rates, we will soon consume the oxygen of the atmosphere faster than it can be replaced. We have no reason to believe that fission or fusion can replace combustion without equal or higher hazards. Medicine men replace midwives and promise to make man into something else. Genetically planned, pharmacologically sweetened, and capable of more protracted sickness. The contemporary ideal is a pan-hygienic world, a world in which all contacts between men and between men and their world are the result of foresight and manipulation. School has become the planned process which tools man for a planned world. The principal tool to trap man in man's trap. It is supposed to shape each man to an adequate level for playing a part in this world game. Inexorably, we cultivate, treat, produce, and school the world out of existence. The military institution is evidently absurd. The absurdity of non-military institutions is more difficult to face. It is even more frightening, precisely because it operates inexorably. We know which switch must stay open to avoid an atomic holocaust. No switch detains an ecological Armageddon. In classical antiquity, man had discovered that the world could be made according to man's plans, and with this insight, he perceived that it was inherently precarious, dramatic, and comical. Democratic institutions evolved, and man was presumed worthy of trust within their framework. Expectations from due process and confidence in human nature kept each other in balance. The traditional professions developed, and with them the institutions needed for their exercise. Surreptitiously, reliance on institutional process has replaced dependence on personal goodwill. The world has lost its humane dimension and reacquired the factual necessity and fatefulness which were characteristics of primitive times. But, while the chaos of the barbarian was constantly ordered in the name of mysterious anthropomorphic gods, today only man's planning can be given as a reason for the world being as it is. Man has become the plaything of scientists, engineers, and planners. We see this logic at work in ourselves and in others. I know a Mexican village through which not more than a dozen cars drive each day. A Mexican was playing dominoes on the new hard surface road in front of his house, where he had probably played and sat since his youth. A car sped through and killed him. The tourist who reported the event to me was deeply upset, and yet he said the man had it coming to him. At first sight, the tourist's remark is no different from the statement of some primitive bushman reporting the death of a fellow who had collided with a taboo and had therefore died. But the two statements carry opposite meanings. The primitive can blame some tremendous and dumb transcendence, while the tourist is in awe of the inexorable logic of the machine. The primitive does not sense responsibility. The tourist senses it, but denies it. In both the primitive and the tourist, the classical mode of drama, the style of tragedy, the logic of personal endeavour and rebellion is absent. The primitive man has not become conscious of it, and the tourist has lost it. The myth of the bushman and the myth of the American are made of inert human forces. Neither experiences tragic rebellion. For the bushman, the event follows the laws of magic. For the American, it follows the laws of science. The event puts him under the spell of the laws of mechanics, which for him govern physical, social, and psychological events. The mood of 1971 is propitious for a major change of direction in search of a hopeful future. Institutional goals continuously contradict institutional products. The poverty program produces more poor. The war in Asia, more Viet Cong. Technical assistance, more underdevelopment. Birth control clinics increase survival rates and boost the population. Schools produce more dropouts, and the curb on one kind of pollution usually increases another. Consumers are faced with the realization that the more they buy, the more deceptions they must swallow. Until recently, it seemed logical that the blame for this pandemic inflation of dysfunctions could be laid either on the limping of scientific discovery behind the technological demands, or on the perversity of ethnic, ideological, or class enemies. Both the expectations of a scientific millennium and of a war to end all wars have declined. For the experienced consumer, there is no way back to a naive reliance on magical technologies. Too many people have had experiences with neurotic computers, hospital-bred infections, and jams wherever there is traffic on the road, in the air, or on the phone. Only 10 years ago, conventional wisdom anticipated a better life based on an increase in scientific discovery. Now the scientist frightens children. The moonshots provide a fascinating demonstration that human failure can be almost eliminated among the operators of complex systems. Yet, this does not allay our fears that the human failure to consume according to instruction might spread out of control. For the social reformer, there is no way back either to the assumptions of the 40s. The hope has vanished that the problem of justly distributing goods can be sidetracked by creating an abundance of them. The cost of the minimum package capable of satisfying modern tastes has skyrocketed. And what makes tastes modern is their obsolescence, prior even to satisfaction. The limits of the earth's resources have become evident. No breakthrough in science or technology could provide every man in the world with the commodities and services which are now available to the poor of the rich countries. For instance, it would take the extraction of 100 times the present amounts of iron, tin, copper and lead to achieve such a goal, with even the lightest alternative technology. Finally, teachers, doctors and social workers realize that their distinct professional ministrations have one aspect, at least, in common. They create further demands for the institutional treatments they provide, faster than they can provide service institutions. Not just some part, but the very logic of conventional wisdom is becoming suspect. Even the laws of economy seem unconvincing outside the narrow parameters which apply to the social geographic area where most of the money is concentrated. Money is indeed the cheapest currency, but only in an economy geared to efficiency measured in monetary terms. Both capitalist and communist countries, in their various forms, are committed to measuring efficiency in cost-benefit ratios expressed in dollars. Capitalism flaunts a higher standard of living as its claim to superiority. Communism boasts of a higher growth rate as an index of its ultimate triumph. But, under either ideology, the total cost of increasing efficiency increases geometrically. The largest institutions compete most fiercely for resources which are not listed in any inventory: the air, the ocean, silence, sunlight, and health. They bring the scarcity of these resources to public attention only when they're almost irremediably degraded. Everywhere nature becomes poisonous, society inhumane, and the inner life is invaded and personal vocation smothered. A society committed to the institutionalization of values identifies the production of goods and services with the demand for such. Education, which makes you need the product, is included in the price of the product. School is the advertising agency which makes you believe that you need the society as it is. In such a society, marginal value has become constantly self-transcendent. It forces the few largest consumers to compete for the power to deplete the earth, to fill their own swelling bellies, to discipline smaller consumers, and to deactivate those who still find satisfaction in making do with what they have. The ethos of non-satiation is thus at the root of physical depredation, social polarization, and psychological passivity. When values have been institutionalized in planned and engineered processes, the members of modern society believe that the good life consists in having institutions which define the values that both they and their society believe they need. Institutional value can be defined as the level of output of an institution. The corresponding value of man is measured by his ability to consume and degrade these institutional outputs, and thus create a new, even higher, demand. The value of institutionalized man depends on his capacity as an incinerator. To use an image, he has become the idol of his handiworks. Man now defines himself as the furnace which burns up the values produced by his tools, and there is no limit to his capacity. He is the act of Prometheus carried to an extreme. The exhaustion and pollution of the earth's resources is, above all, the result of a corruption in man's self-image, of a regression in his consciousness. Some would like to speak about a mutation of collective consciousness which leads to a conception of man as an organism dependent not on nature and individuals, but rather on institutions. This institutionalization of substantive values, this belief that a planned process of treatment ultimately gives results desired by the participant, this consumer ethos is at the heart of the Promethean fallacy. Efforts to find a new balance in the global milieu depend on the deinstitutionalization of values. The suspicion that something is structurally wrong with the vision of Homo faber is common to a growing minority in capitalist, communist, and underdeveloped countries alike. This suspicion is the shared characteristic of a new elite. To it belong people of all classes, incomes, faiths, and civilizations. They have become wary of the myths of the majority, of scientific utopias, of ideological diabolism, and of the expectation of the distribution of goods and services with some degree of equality. They share with the majority the sense of being trapped. They share with the majority the awareness that most new policies adopted by broad consensus consistently lead to results which are glaringly opposed to their stated aims. Yet, whereas the Promethean majority of would-be spacemen still evades the structural issue, the emergent minority is critical of the scientific deus ex machina, the ideological panacea, the hunt for devils and witches. This minority begins to formulate its suspicion that our constant deceptions tie us to contemporary institutions as the chains bound Prometheus to his rock. Hopeful trust and classical irony, eironia, must conspire to expose the Promethean fallacy. Prometheus is usually thought to mean foresight, or sometimes even he who makes the North Star progress. He tricked the gods out of their monopoly on fire, taught men to use it in the foraging of iron, became the god of technologists, and wound up in iron chains. The Pythia of Delphi has now been replaced by a computer which hovers above panels and punch cards. The hexameters of the oracle have given way to 16-bit codes of instructions. Man the helmsman has turned the rudder over to the cybernetic machine. The ultimate machine emerges to direct our destinies. Children fantasize flying their spacecrafts away from a crepuscular earth. From the perspectives of the man on the moon, Prometheus could recognize sparkling blue Gaia as the planet of hope and as the Ark of Mankind. A new sense of the finiteness of the earth and a new nostalgia now can open man's eyes to the choice of his brother Epimetheus to wed the earth with Pandora. At this point, the Greek myth turns into hopeful prophecy, because it tells us that the son of Prometheus, who is Deucalion, the helmsman of the ark, who, like Noah, outrode the flood to become the father of a new mankind, which he made from the earth with Pyra, the daughter of Epimetheus and Pandora. We are gaining insight into the meaning of the pythos, which Pandora brought from the gods, as being the inverse of the box, our vessel and ark. We now need a name for those who value hope above expectations. We need a name for those who love people more than products, for those who believe that no people are uninteresting. Their fate is like the chronicle of planets. Nothing in them is not particular, and planet is dissimilar from planet. We need a name for those who love the earth on which each can meet the other. And if a man lived in obscurity, making his friends in that obscurity, obscurity is not uninteresting. We need a name for those who collaborate with their Promethean brother in the lightning of the fire and the shaping of iron, but who do so to enhance their ability to tend and care and wait upon the other, knowing that to each his world is private, and in that world one excellent minute, and in that world one tragic minute. These are private. I suggest that these hopeful brothers and sisters be called Epimethean men. Now, if you thought that went a bit funny at the end, that wasn't Illich being willfully obscure. It's easier, actually, if you see the transcript, which is available from this show's website, because he does interpolate three sections from a poem, People, by Yevgeny Yevtushenko. Or you could try re-listening to it, which I always advise with Illich. It feels good to have finished reading that book. All the readings are now compiled, and that's available for download from our audiobooks page, because I think it's one of the most important texts we've ever read. I keep hearing people who seem very clear on a lot of points, and then come out with statements like, we deserve better schools for our children. I want to say, no, we don't want a world of schools. Why not let kids be the people they want to be? But I've said enough on that, because I'll finish the book and we can get on to other topics. I think I'd better do a show on Iceland, because the Icelandic people, when presented with a criminal financial class who were going to lay some serious austerity on them, they knew what to do and they pulled it off. And that's why we've not heard much about them. So if you've got any material on Iceland and the saucepan revolution, then please let me know. And next week it's the 10th anniversary of a certain announcement from the Pentagon. So if you have anything pertaining to that day or the following day that you'd like included on the show, then you've got a day or two to email me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. Now, if you'd like to re-listen to this show, it's available as an MP3 download from our archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. And 566 other shows are also available. There's a mailing list for any discussion of the show at altruists.org/unwelcome. And we have a Twitter feed announcing new episodes at twitter.com/unwelcomeguests. The music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. I hope this show has helped you move into a more active, a more Epimethean stage of life, one in which you are not content to be a mere functionary in some larger system, to play a role that's been assigned to you, one in which you are actually alive. Keep living the brave man.